Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we get to chat with Chris from Direct Sun Games about his specialty, puzzles in D&D. You know, we've wrestled with puzzle designs in the past. We're hoping Chris can tell us how to use them without hitting roadblocks, frustration, or breaking immersion. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I will mention, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat hosted on our Discord server, which you can join by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier level, and you'll get a link to join our private Discord server. Get your account over there all set up before the end of the show, and maybe about 10 minutes or so after the end of the show, we will be there to chat with you all live.
We love our patrons so much. We love getting a chance to touch base every week. For example, our patron Backwiz is checking in that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube and ReStreamBot. Thank you so much for that. Also, I'm going to give a shout out. You know, today is there's a huge blizzard happening right now over most of the U.S. So we hope that all you viewers are snug and cozy and safe and you know about your neighbors and you're warm. And please watch out for dangerous stuff this weekend like snow and cold and ice. So we want you all here gaming for a long time in the future. Chris, Mr. Direct Sun himself, thank you so much for making time on this wintry Sunday to join us. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I've been a long fan of the show. We're watching a catch up. Y'all are great. It's not snowing outside for me today. I'm in the Pacific Northwest. It was a little bit crisp, but sunny and nice.
Well, score one for Seattle. Score an unusual one for Seattle. I mean, you got to be opposite. So that sounds good to me. Also flustered from the compliment, so that'll get you everywhere. We've been reading some of your past adventures recently, and I really adored your work. Maybe tell us where you got on this thread of really focusing on puzzle games, puzzle dungeons.
Yeah, so I grew up with one of my first Zelda games, I think, was Zelda 1, and I was too young for it. It was frustrating. But I was old enough for Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time on the N64. I loved it so much. I love the polished dungeon experience. I love everything about that game. I go back and I replay it a lot. It's a really good, I think, lesson on how to do puzzles. The incremental lessons that you get over there, the testing of the knowledge that you get from doing it, just showing you everything up front. And when I got into D&D, and it was with 5e at first,
yeah,
I thought that there was something missing, right? I always thought that there should be that polished dungeon experience. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine who I met through Discord around the start of the pandemic, he ran a game, an open table of Stonehell with OSE. And that was my introduction to the OSR. And I said, this is what dungeons could be like. This is what the game could be like. I had no idea. And I was hooked. And I started making dungeons, and I started making the puzzle dungeons, and I started making that experience that I wanted because I knew that it was possible.
Wow. I love that. You know, I'll say, Paul and I used to have a joint campaign in the third edition era, and I had a close friend that joined us and similarly was a little bit kind of flustered, I guess, all along. And then at some point I ran him through the classic D&D adventure, The Gem and the Staff, which I think has the code 01, totally a puzzle tournament type situation. At the end of it, my friend also went, oh, well this is what D&D should be like. This is what it should be like all the time. Why haven't we been doing this?
I've not read The Gem and the Staff, but I do recall you talking about it on the first time that you guys talked about Puzzle Dungeons, maybe like 6 years ago, I think it was.
It's one of my favorite things.
I think we live played Gem and the Staff here, didn't we, Dan? Didn't we stream that at some point?
Oh, we did. Oh, we did with you playing.
I think
right?
we did. Yeah, I think we did. I think you can go look it up. That's a fun one. Or get a hold of the module and check it out. I want to ask Chris. We were talking about like inspiration from video games, and Dan's bringing up the Gem and the Staff, which is a one-on-one, one DM, one player type of game. When you're designing your puzzle scenarios, how do you deal with the problem of like one player is solving the puzzle while everyone else waits?
I understand where that question is coming from, but I would say that the types of puzzles that I like, that doesn't happen. The types of puzzles that I try and put in my adventures, it's not like a Sudoku or something that you hand to the players and someone's working on it as they go. It's more, this is what you see in the environment. This is how you're exploring. We're playing D&D. What do you do? How do you react? One person's going to explore this. One person's going to interact with this. I follow those dungeon crawl and exploration procedures from OSE. And that's how they discover each of the unique mechanics of the dungeon. That's how they learn the lessons of the dungeon, how it works, how things are a little bit weirder than here than on the outside. And then through that, they get presented incremental challenges which build on that previous information. So it's never one person's on their own, or if it is, it's just how the game usually runs, which is, I'm doing this, I'm listening at the door, I'm looking at the key that's floating midair, you know?
Yeah, I've noticed that from reading your stuff, that like a lot of the puzzles are more revolving around like physical objects in the world, things that you can observe, manipulate, talk to, right? You're never in this case of like translate this strange text or, you know, right. I don't know, cross the room without stepping on the wrong tiles kind of stuff. I mean, maybe the latter one actually even still fits. But you know what I mean? Like not something where like you're giving one player a handout and they're staring at it and the rest of the group is
I never liked cipher puzzles. It always really took me out of it when there was a cipher puzzle. I know this might be controversial, but I don't like riddles. I know that they're classic for D&D, but I'm not very good at riddles. And it's taken me out before, too, because some riddles are based on the language, too, on English. So, you know, there'll be like a play on words, which wouldn't really make sense to me in the fiction. Yeah. Maybe common is English, but, you know, the mouth of a river, it might not be correct, or you must pick out the letters that spell open. It's just very arbitrary and just not too fun, in my opinion, for me.
You know, it's fascinating because I think like riddles come up a lot, like especially when you're looking at, say, like a Sphinx as a monster in your adventure. And that's something I've struggled with a lot myself. I'm always like, you know, anytime you start getting kind of, you know, I would say like Bilbo Bagginsy, right, where you're like, you know, we're going to have a riddle contest. It feels a little weird and forced. The one case I can think of where I really enjoyed having a Sphinx speak riddles at my players, my riddle wasn't even really a riddle. It was just a trick question about the history of the world that they were in, the fictional world. Yeah. I had the Sphinx say, you know, who won the race in this famous ancient race between these two parties, these two guys? And if the players knew the background of the history of the world, which they had lots of material about, you know, and in our case they did, one of them piped up and immediately said, well, that's a bullshit question because that race was interrupted by the breakout of war.
Yes. favorite Sphinx is in the caverns of Thracia. And this Sphinx, you can ask questions, but you have to pay for them to answer the questions, right? And so I don't know if it was written this way, but when my players encountered it, you know, they're like, the Sphinx says, you know, ask your question. And they do. And they say, okay, now pay me. And they pay them the coins. And then like, okay, ask me another question. And they did. And then they doubled or like times 10 the amount, right? So if it was 10, it was 100. And they're like, oh no, we have a limited amount of time before we really cannot afford this.
That's brilliant.
And that was fun.
Yeah.
And of course, Thracia was by the great Janelle Jacquees. And that was another one where actually my partner Isabel actually played that and was like, oh, I get it. I get D&D now. We had a great time with that adventure. That was one of the many great elements in there. You know, okay. So before we get to in the depths, I just have to compliment Chris, your adventures. And I've had an opportunity to really dig into Seer Sanctum and Aberrant Reflections. And I really like, I've really liked the design. I've also liked the design layout work, and also the artwork is really impressive. And in particular with the aberrant use of color, really, really tickled me. And it's a common use of color in the text, in the maps, and also the artwork, and using that coding in the artwork, the way that it was done to link up the information really, really tickled me. And I don't know how universal you could make that work, but boy, that looked really unique and really clever and really informative to me. So really good job on that.
Thank you so much. I've really been lucky to work with such great artists and layout artists. Gene Verne did the layout for Aberrant Reflections. Gene is also part of a project which is also crowdfunding for Zine Month, Twisting Unseen, which is a Mothership adventure. So I'm really excited to see the layout on that and the adventure itself. Chris Ayers on that as the author. But yeah, the color coding, Aberrant Reflections is a mirror themed dungeon. So some of the clues, you look through a special mirror and it shows something different. The keys, I tried to make it not too overwhelming, because there's basically a mirror version of the dungeon. So there's special text in like a little purple font, which is also there. Like, here's what you see. And then the purple font says, this is what's there in the aberrant world. And then the images, that was an idea that kind of came to me when I was looking at the layout. I'm like, wait a minute. I mean, this image is completely in the other world. Let's just tint that the same color too, so that's a little bit more obvious for the referee to see what elements are there or not. Yeah. And that's I really love visual aids.
Yeah. And what happens is a single illustration is actually giving you two different views. As you can see on site, like what this looks like in the normal world, and also what this also looks in the aberrant world. So it's kind of like two illustrations in one. I mean, there's a world where you could have like 3D glasses, or like one of those like old school adventures that have the colored viewer, right? And you can say, here's what it looks in this form, and here's what it looks in the other form without the viewer. So
I experimented really with a lot of different ideas for Aberrant Reflections for the presentation before I settled on like the purple text. I was thinking, you know, maybe we could use the zine format, turn it upside down. If you wanted to look at the key another way, and I said, that's going to really suck for people with digital. But that would be a fun artifact. I was like, maybe I could write in like, a UV kind of pen, and then they could take a black light and like look at it that way. But I'm glad that I settled on the purple color instead.
That's great.
Let me jump in here. I warned Chris before we went on that I was going to have a lot of questions about Aberrant Reflections, because I've been digging through it a lot.
Sure, fire away.
But let me touch on what we were just discussing earlier. First of all, let me back up and let me say, I really appreciate the writing style here, right? And it totally unsurprised that your intro to OSR was, oh my god, my brain has just lost it.
Old School Essentials? Is that?
No. The Adventure.
Old School Essentials. Wow. Yeah. My friend ran me through Stonehell.
Stonehell.
Thank you. Right. Yeah. Stonehell. Michael Curtis. Also similar writing style, right? In that kind of like one-page dungeon style where everything's real short and concise, right? A lot of this, you know, in this text anyway, like in addition to the glorious illustrations, you know, all the text is in this very concise little nuggets, little bullets with a lot of what I think of as white space. I need a lot of space for interpretation in between, which I adore. So to tie this back to having to pay for answers, right? Aberrant Adventures totally has that, right? You've got a ghoul creature that you can discuss or you can make questions of, and he demands payment in the form of body parts. What jumped out at me is got a list of like a couple questions there of like specific things. Like if the players ask about this, he might respond in this way. And every response begins with a little callback to the body part in particular that they have paid. Is that, are you just trying to like hint at how this creature should talk? Or are you implying that that this specific question costs an eyeball, whereas that specific question costs a tongue?
Wow, it works both ways, doesn't it, Paul?
It does. Yeah. I knew I wasn't going to get a real answer to that one.
What's fun about that is Gene came back to me and he said, hey, this table does not fit. And he's like, what are we going to do? Maybe we could cut the text or add some other stuff. I said, well, maybe if I format it in this way, it'll work. And it did. I'm really happy with how it came out. I think it gives referees an idea of how this person talks and how they might express what they want. So you're totally right. I think that it should cost an eyeball for one thing or another. And I leave it to the referee whether or not they require that to be fresh or not from the players. But I'm glad you mentioned I'm glad you mentioned the Oracle because
right. Sorry, we're talking over each other now because we're excited. But I love that like a clairvoyant ghoul being paid in body parts, because of course I imagine that he's immediately gonna eat that. Like, oh, delicious, thank you.
I really love that character, Isaac, the emaciated ghoul, because how he's written, he has to stay in there, but he's clairvoyant. He knows what's going to happen, and he has all the answers. I love playing that character because he can be as calm as a cucumber, because he holds all of the cards. He knows what's going to happen. He knows the players' names, right? If they threaten him, he's like, okay, kill me. What am I going to do? You need me, and you're going to pay me for the answers. It's a fun NPC to play.
That is brilliant. Brilliant.
But okay, oracles are really good hack. Sorry, go on. Yeah.
That's great. Just before I forget, so Paul was asking about the possibly one player focus question, and I get it, and I know it, like a lot of your puzzles, you need the whole party to coordinate on something, which I think is clever. What I don't see here, how many players do you expect in your adventures at your table?
Yeah, I think the sweet spot is probably about 5 players. I know you have talked about the sweet spot in your games before. I think 3 is a really great number also. Are we rehashing probably an old episode thing?
We are.
It's probably so. I wanted your input on it, Chris.
Yeah, I think between 3 and 6 players is a perfect number for these adventures or any adventure in general. How I tend to play these days are 1-shots, 2-shot, 3-shots is how long they usually take. That's what works best for my schedule. I've done the campaigns before, which are super fun. But this way, our group gets to rotate who DMs, what games we play. There's a lot of breaks in between shorter campaigns. We're able to try different games like Slug Blaster. We had like an 8-session game of that, which is like a collaborative storytelling game where you play teenagers skateboarding the multiverse. And it's a fun experience to have. So I have always tried to design these games in a way that would be easy for me to play and run at the table.
All right, I want to jump in and ask. Tons of questions. I want to ask you about your maps, and specifically the map in Aberrant Adventures. Although I think this happens in the Seer Sanctum as well, if I remember correctly. Anyway, certainly in Aberrant Reflections, there's The PDF comes with two maps, right? A player map and a GM map. Player map just sort of is scrubbed of all of the details, but still shows the general layout. And we talked about how, for you, a lot of the puzzle is exploring the space, interacting with the physical, you know, objects within the space. How do you expect to use that player map? Are you giving that to your players up front? Do they automatically know the whole layout of the dungeon?
With Aberrant Reflections, I've used VTT. So with the dynamic lighting, it's nice. And then I have the GM layer on top. So they can't see the GM layer, but it matches up perfectly. I can see what's in the Aberrant, and I can describe and tell them everything, and they can see as they move through. At cons, I saw this on Reddit a while back, and I've been doing it at cons ever since. You take the map, you print it out. It's fine if it's on an 8.5 by 11 sheet. You don't need it huge. You take it, you have a piece of overhead plastic paper, which you can get. It's fairly cheap. You tape it onto it. You mix in some black paint and some soap, dish soap. You paint the top of the plastic sheet, right? It dries. You might need a few layers of this. It dries. And then you have a scratch-off map. You place one mini, represents the party, and you can scratch it off as they go along.
I have never heard of that. That's amazing.
Me too. Me too. Wow. Holy moly.
It's pretty simple. It takes a little bit of prep. That's always fun to do with Aberrant Reflections. With the Seer's Sanctum, the map is super simple, and I designed it with the Theater of the Mind in mind. So I've run it with the scratch-off before and a VTT, but Theater of the Mind works great. And Theater of Mind works great for a familiar tower also.
Yeah, I've seen similar techniques, not the scratch-off, that's very clever, but I've certainly seen folks do stuff where like they print the map and maybe, you know, cut out pieces of black construction paper or something to tape over or stick over, stick with Funtac, what have you, so you can peel off.
The players love scratching off too, so they get involved.
Yeah, I could see that.
Oh boy, let's see the next room.
Yeah, Dan may remember once ran an adventure that involved a hex crawl where I had made little magnets out of blank hex magnets, and so had the whole thing on a magnetic whiteboard, and then just stuck. You could just peel off the hexes one at a time. You know, for whatever reason, I'm just so used to playing live these days. The idea of like using it in a VTT and using kind of either Fog of War or just, you know, a visibility layer, just for whatever reason didn't strike me. So I was like a little confused by the player's map when I saw it. How does this get used? But that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I include VTT maps, the player, and the referee maps with all of them. Nice. Sorry, Dan, what's your hard question?
That's really nice. So here's my hardish question. Now, both the adventures of yours that I saw were specifically listed for lower level adventurers, so D&D type characters, levels maybe 1 through 4. How would you handle higher level dungeon environments? And you know, I've gone on record. We've had debates on the show here before where I've I'm kind of sticking my heels in on this, is that in high level D&D, you basically can't run a murder mystery procedural because there's just too many resources to just solve the problem. So what have you done, or what would you do to modify things for high level D&D characters?
Yeah, that's a really hard design obstacle. Because you really need to keep in mind the system that you're running with, what spells are available at certain levels. There are a bunch of puzzle breaking spells, depending on the puzzle that you're designing, right? I know you're talking about stuff like pass wall, fly, all these things that could circumvent various challenges. And then if you do design your puzzles that way, you got to think about the resources that players have, how many uses of those spells that they have, how many players. It's really a nightmare to think about all of those things. So I think the easiest way that you design a puzzle for a high level play is to make that stuff not matter. So you design the puzzles in a way where they're using different skills to interact with the world. I think Aberrant Reflections is a really good example of that, because they're not going to be able to get in the Aberrant with what they have. I guess maybe if they have something like Gate, I would probably rule that they could get in there.
I'm also thinking about like information gathering stuff. So like I'm thinking of Commune or Contact Higher Plane, or there's a, you know, there's a D&D cleric spell, Find the Path, which is just like, if you can't get in someplace, cast this spell and it just tells you how to get in there.
I think that's fine. I really like the idea of players choosing their own difficulty. And I think this comes up with a broad range of levels. Sometimes people say 1 through 3, sometimes they say like 1 through 5, right? And they say a really careful party of first level players can get through, and you know, if they're smart, right? But level 4 players, they can tackle a lot more of the challenges, right? And so if you design your puzzles that way, not necessarily with level in mind, but with player skill, you can say, here are some harder challenges that you might be able to tackle if you have the resources or if you have the ideas, but you can just leave them there if you want. And you can just think about them and come back later and do it. So I don't know if that fully answers the question. I hate it when modules say, this spell doesn't work, this spell doesn't work, this one has a different effect in this area. And it comes down to the system, right? If I had control of the system and the puzzles, I would be happy. I would love a capsule game where it's like Legend of Zelda. You have a bunch of different puzzle dungeons. There's a very simple system that you go through. And, you know, there's control over what abilities you get, when and where. But because I'm designing this for OSE, so you could pluck it into your... pop it into your campaign or run it as a one-shot or anything else. I have to think about those things in mind. So I'd say for higher level play, try and make it not matter.
Great. Yeah, I was gonna right, like for the information gathering spells, of course, you know, in Amberne Reflections specifically, right, Chris has already provided this in the form of Isaac the Clairvoyant Ghoul. I would think that the only thing that access to those spells really gets you is now you don't have to pay Isaac.
You have to feed the ghoul. Do you like, what's your opinion of Tomb of Horrors, the kind of the classic, like one of the earliest adventures, and a couple of things that came before and after like that, but do you like Tomb of Horrors as an adventure?
I've run Tomb of Horrors many times. I love it as a funnel. I also saw this on Reddit way back when, and that's the players are controlling 25 kobolds, right? And they're just going through the dungeon and they're interacting with the world. They have those multiple characters. It's a super cool funnel. It's got tons of artwork, lots of first person view illustrations, which I really love, and I try and include in my adventures too, so you can give out to the players. And there's a lot of fun challenges in that. There's a lot of fun challenges in Tomb of Horrors. And the hints and stuff, when I first read that, I said, there's no way the players are ever going to get this. And I said, they have the kobolds, they can just brute force and try this if they need to. I was super surprised. A bunch of players got them. They're like, oh, we're in the pit trap. Really? We got to search for a secret door. And I'm like, what?
How did you come to that conclusion from that text?
Yeah. It was so ambiguous to me.
It makes a huge bit. I've talked about it. I had a happy little accident where I gave them part of it, and so I have a found experiment of here's my players playing without the riddle, and here are them playing with it. It's just night and day, complete night and day. And I was also really stunned by how well it helped.
I do like a lot of the weird challenges and stuff in there because it really gets them working together.
Yeah,
there's a lot of fun exploration stuff in there. I don't think it should be played straight as, you know, a high level party goes through. I think it's great as a funnel for exploration. I also love White Plume Mountain. I think there are wonderful challenges in there. I love the frictionless room. These are not puzzle. These are not dungeons that I would make today. I would like my puzzle dungeons to follow a theme with lessons and puzzles that are related. And don't just kind of come out of the blue. When you have flesh golems with prime numbers, or, you know, just numbers on their chest, and you got to find the one with the prime. It's okay, but it's totally unrelated to everything else. I would make White Plume Mountain have a bunch of challenges related to the mountain itself. The hot, the steam, the water and stuff. I really love the challenge with the bubble and the crab. Right. I love that.
Yeah.
After I watch Moana, I always make that crab underneath with a nice magic sword on top, buried under the sand. That's a wonderful encounter. But I would make the puzzles related, right? Choose a theme for your puzzle dungeon, build on it with lessons that the players can incrementally learn, and then your puzzles will make sense to the players. They will naturally solve them and get those aha, eureka moments, which is what I really strive for. That's a really fun experience when you can pull it off the table.
Nice. We should probably talk about a film in your tower, right? So Paul, whatever other questions you have, please jump in on top of me and inject those. So a film in your tower is Chris's next adventure, and you're crowdfunding that in the next couple of weeks, I think. Tell us what that's
about. Right, February 2nd. So it's coming up really soon. I've been working on this for over a year now. I playtested at GaryCon. That was one of the first playtests. And it went great. It's really fun to play this in person because there's a physical prop that kind of changes its meaning as the game goes on. And yeah, I'll explain what it is. It's an escape room style puzzle dungeon, and it takes place in a wizard tower. That's all I'm going to say without the spoilers. Okay. But it's really fun. It's going to put a smile on your players' faces when you put it in front of them and when they solve it. Every single player, I mean, if you are in real life, everyone's getting involved with this. It's, I keep saying that it's fun without explaining anything, but.
So viewers, I'm addressing you now. If you think you're going to be a player for Chris's A Familiar Tower, maybe pause this video and come back after you've watched it, because there may possibly be first time in the world spoilers for this adventure in the next couple minutes. If you are a DM considering running it, stay tuned, because I think we're maybe for the first time going to reveal part of it. Now, before we do that, Chris, I will say the one thing that I saw in some promotional materials online is I did see this described as a non-Euclidean wizard's tower. And, of course, that immediately made me very happy to hear that, because among my favorite adventures is the old school Dragon magazine adventure that scoped out Baba Yaga's hut as an enormous tesseract on the inside, kind of like a Doctor Who bigger on the inside thing. And when I got my hands on the tesseract dungeon that you partially have to kind of stock out yourself, that got stuck in my head, and I've been thinking about it ever since. So you say non-Euclidean adventure, I am there. So delighted already at the idea. And that's pretty much all I personally know at this point.
Cool. Hey, you want me to tell you some more?
I definitely do.
Okay, I got something to show you.
Visual aids.
We have show and tell.
our apologies to the audio podcast listeners at this point. We'll do our best.
I saw part of this. Yeah.
This is the wizard tower. Actual tower. This is the wizard tower made out of an oatmeal box that my son helped me make. We colored it together. This is just a piece of twine for some string. There's a window up top. It's pretty simple. There's a hole here for some doors, and that's it. It's got a tinfoil hat roof, right? This is the tower. You put this in front of your players, and they say, wow, that's a cool visual aid. Here are some 28mm miniatures. That's awesome. We're playing D&D. Look at this. It's it's the map of where we are, right? And then they go through They go through the rooms. Things are a little bit weird. Things are bigger than they should be sometimes. There's a big 12-foot long key on the wall in one room. It's a huge key. Why is it that big? Like, oh, maybe we gotta like shrink it down at some point and get that to work too. Sure, okay. And then one room, they see it. They see the room. They see this tower. It's in the center of this water table, right? It's there. And they realize that there are small versions of themselves inside of this tower, right?
Yes.
They're in this room over here. They stick their finger over here. They see this gigantic finger coming through the window. And then all of a sudden, as you get to the challenges and all the things in the game, the players are huddled around the tower itself. And they're like, okay, well, I'm going to go through the window. I said, well, here's your mini. Have fun. Wow. And so they interact with it that way. They stick their hands in there and move it around. So all of a sudden, it turns from one thing that they think it is to another thing and a prop that they can manipulate in the game. Which is awesome. And I had Sam Amelli, Skullboy, so he's worked up a texture wrap for this thing. The door and the window are separate, but you can make your own out of an oatmeal box or a paper towel or whatever, and you print it out, and you have it there. It's so simple. You don't even need a five-year-old to help you make it. You can do it yourself.
I tell you how much I adore that part. I love the constructing instruction. That's off. And the other thing, I'm sorry, I gotta grab a book here. Okay, so this hand's gonna get through. Okay, so it's not exactly the same thing, but there's an anthology of mathematical based stories called Mathonauts that I picked up years ago, edited by the great Rudy Rucker. And if I can find this story, it is it's like. It's called Love Comes to the Middleman by Mark Laidlaw, and it's set in a universe where there's a person in an apartment, and on their wall they have a tiny apartment building with teeny tiny little Lilliputian people living in the apartment building, and also outside their window they're part of an even larger apartment building. In the apartment of a colossal giant, and so on and so forth, infinitely in both directions. And so, and part of the plot is, I think this person like gets information about one of the residents, and then connects them up, gets information from outside, and connects them up with another teeny tiny resident, and they go on a date, and it's lovely, and everybody just adores everybody else. And so that bigger and smaller play, right? Just a fabulous idea. I'm so glad that's an adventure. Oh my God, I'm glad you shared that with us.
Right on, yeah. I'm super excited about it. I think everyone's going to have a good time with it. I hope it does well. Please click the follow button, or if it's already started, if it's after February 2nd, go back the thing. My other adventures and prints and stuff will be on there. The revamped version of Seer Sanctum will be on there. I got new artwork from Monk Cow. This stuff is beautiful. Jesse Winter also did the new layout for Seer Sanctum, which I love. Jesse Winter is also crowdfunding their own puzzle dungeon, which is Outcast Uncelian, the Ooze Between, which is an ooze-themed puzzle dungeon. There's actually a bunch of puzzle dungeons, more puzzle dungeons in the world now. I hosted Puzzle Dungeon Jam from November to like the middle of December. And we got some awesome puzzle dungeons from some creators. I was super happy to read through the entries. I actually started my own amateur podcast with that to provide feedback. You can watch that on YouTube if you want. They're long. You don't have to watch the whole thing. I'm sorry. But I do interview some other creators in the beginning who give me some help on those. And I was just so amazed by the outpouring of that stuff. I got to play test a bunch of dungeons, which is fun because I don't get to play in a lot of puzzle dungeons. So that was a really fun experience. So yeah, if you want to check out those entries too, the jam is at puzzledungeon.com/jam. And the crowdfunder for Familiar Tower is puzzledungeon.com/tower.
Great. And we have those links in the description on YouTube.
Yeah, likewise, there's a link to the backer kit for A Familiar Tower in the chat now. So if you're watching live right now, go check out that link. I know it's not going to launch, as we mentioned, until early February, but you can get your email address plugged in there so you get the announcement when it goes live.
Yeah. That follow button gets backer kit off my back because they give me a percentage and they said, this is how likely you are to succeed or fail based on the numbers that you have accumulated so far. So it gives me less stress to see the number going in the right direction.
Excellent.
Fantastic. And that's about a week away from when we're currently taping this. So yeah, hopefully if you are watching this in February, just go and back it right now. Fantastic. Oh man, I'm having a hard time to focus on anything else than the than the giant size play of the in your promotional materials, you showed the tower. Frankly, you showed the tower. So I've had my eyeballs on the tower. It's like, what is this? What is that for? Why is that prominent part of this? You really scratched my itch to know what it's used for. Go ahead, Paul.
So I noticed in the two adventures that you have out now, the Seer Sanctum and Aberrant Reflections, that there's definitely this thematic component of sort of grotesque or almost horror adjacent kind of content. Is that are we going to see the same thing in A Familiar Tower?
There is a little bit of that. There's one room that I'm thinking of, but it's not as prevalent as it is in the other adventures. This one is a lot more lighthearted, I think, and Sam Mameli's illustrations really capture that. They capture the feel for it. The name A Familiar Tower is a little bit of a double meaning also, because you see the tower and you're like, whoa, there's a familiar tower. I remember that as the players see it on the table. But also, there's a bunch of familiars in there from a wizard who you don't immediately know if they're there or not. You're there just to loot their tower. And their familiars are there. So you have to interact with the denizens over there, figure out the relationships between them, see who would be useful to achieving your goal, which is to ultimately get the hell out of here. When the players first arrive, they don't know that they're trapped, right? They've just been sailing. Eventually, the lights go out. The stars and the moon disappear from the sky. It's blackness. You see this tower illuminated in the distance. Why is it so black? Why does this feel off? It's because they're actually the size of a 28 millimeter figure sailing on a water table within the tower already. So when the players realize, like, oh, let's take this treasure, let's get the hell back on the boat and go, and they sail off and they hit the edge of the table, boof, whoops. There's a little bit more to this that we need to figure out.
Fabulous. That is awesome.
But yeah, gross stuff, horror stuff has been an influence in my writing and adventures and stuff before. It's weird how much I notice after the fact when I step away from the work and come back and say, oh, that's something that scares me or frightens me or gives me a feeling of a moment of a memory from a past. So that's probably why it came out subconsciously in my writing. Sorry, you were going to say something, Dan.
I'm going to cut Dan off. I'm cutting you off, Dan, because I want to follow up on this, because this is really fascinating. So the reason I've been, as I've been digging through Aberrant Reflections, I think I mentioned in some past episodes, I'm running a quest game for a group, and I've been looking for more adventures like this, more adventures that are not as focused on the combat aspect, right, where more of the adventure can focus on exploration, manipulation of the world, negotiation with interesting NPCs, anything that's not just raw violence, because that's not my group's jam. So the thing that jumped out at me about this is, like, the content's right there, but some of that more kind of body horror stuff doesn't really fit the theme of what we've got going. We're more in this kind of, fairy tale-esque, a lot of, like, fae and fairy-influenced stuff. Now I've been looking and digging through this adventure, and immediately what jumped in my brain is like, well, I could change this. Like, I could definitely reskin this. It, you know, instead of, you know, horrible tentacle monsters, they're, you know, weird, mischievous fae. Not that hard. But I would love to hear from you, Chris, if you feel like, am I ruining it? Am I ruining it by changing it from, you know, horrible extra dimensional monsters to mischievous fairies?
I don't think so. My preference is probably more towards survival horror than fantasy and fae and trickster horror. There's something about survival horror which really draws me in, and I think it can be done in D&D at the right power levels. One of my favorite adventures by Arnold Kemp is Lair of the Lamb, which is a funnel where there's this monster that's hunting you and you have to escape, and it's some horrible stuff. And so I tried to draw on that a little bit with Aberrant Reflections, but the players can still leave and stuff. But I think that giving the players more than one goal is a good idea, because they can focus on one thing or another. And then, so one of those things is kind of like disease, right? In Aberrant Reflections with the body horror stuff, there's some stuff that can transform you into something else. And you need to, you know, maybe find a cure and see what's going on over here. There's a motivation for you to keep moving and explore as much as you can. And that should give you information about the puzzles and also hopefully get you what you need to get stuff done. I could totally see there being trickster fae and stuff over here using the mirrors and coming from over there. It doesn't have to be horrible spider-like creatures that give you a disease. It could be ones that curse you and, I don't know, make your face look backwards or trap you in a certain way, make you grow wings. That's not, it's like body horror adjacent, maybe, I would say. And you could still search for the cures to those.
Yeah, yeah. I think the whole idea of there being like another parallel world and, some denizens of that world that either want to escape or want to trap you within it, all that feels like right on brand to me when I'm thinking about a fae inspired adventure. So I thought it was going to translate real well. So I think it's going to work great. I was just very curious to hear your input on it.
I'm super excited to hear how that goes, Paul. Please let me know.
I will. I have ideas already, and I'm keeping them to myself a little bit just in case my players are watching this. Not telling you.
I want to touch on something else with the body horror too while I'm remembering it with Zine Month, because another project that is coming out, which is definitely body horror, but also a puzzle dungeon, which came out of the Puzzle Dungeon Jam, which is crowdfunding for Zine Month by Cameron Mass. Beautiful artwork. I don't want you to look it up and show it now. There should probably be like a body horror warning for this. But there's this portal to the dimension of flesh, which is opened. There's just the right amount of eyeballs. There's way too many eyeballs and teeth and orifices on this thing. And players got to solve puzzles around this flesh-covered reservoir, basically. It's called a reservoir. Also crowdfunding for Zine Month.
Wow.
You know what? Just go check out Zine Month. It's on I Want to Play Games, I think is the website. And there's other stuff besides body horror there. There's other stuff besides puzzle dungeons. It's the whole month of February. It's community driven. And there's a lot of fun stuff that comes out of there every year.
That sounds really impressive. Oh, yeah, Paul's currently playing Quest. I've said many times before, if you're playing D&D, you're going to wind up in horror at some point, and whether you want to or not.
Yeah, I'm immediately reminded, frankly, and not to say I don't like that kind of content. I enjoy it. It's just not for this particular campaign. But I'm immediately reminded, frankly, of a lot of the Lamentations of the Flame Princess content, right? I'm pretty sure there's something in one of them where something curses you to just infinitely grow teeth until your head explodes. I'm like, that's...
I remember that
wonderfully
one.
Horrible.
Yeah. Lots of grotesque stuff in that.
Wow.
Love it. Love it.
Is my cleric a dentist?
let me get this one last question while we still have time and we are very rapidly running out. But I noticed that you spent a little time in some of the text of Seer's Sanctum. I can't remember if this appears in Avernus Reflections as well, about like what to do if the party just gets stuck. Mm-hmm. Right, that's definitely nice. A fear, I think, when running these kind of puzzles of like, what if the party just either can't figure it out, or worse, I think in Seer's Sanctum, you talk about like they could accidentally destroy the things that are the way out.
Yeah. My best advice to that is just let them fail. There's other ways, I think, that they could solve these puzzles. And I think if they really want to, they can come back. If they break the items that are important to solving the puzzles, they're going to know that. The main puzzle, they can see an item that was just like the one that they broke. And they're like, oh, whoops, we probably needed that. I think, a clever party would go back to town and say, can anyone repair this magic item that we need to solve this and figure out what's going on? And they can do that. They can go back and they can use options available to them outside the dungeon. You can do anything in the TTRPG world.
No, not a video game. Assumed, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I assumed that like in Aberrant Reflections, the whole purpose of the mirror shard golem there, who's there to like clean up and fix things, is exactly to prevent this. Like, what if they smash all the mirrors? Well, there's a creature in here who's going to wander around and...
he's a powerful... Well, they are a powerful force to be reckoned with, but they could be taken out, right? What happens if they smash them and take them out of the equation? But I do have a little bit on how to adjudicate puzzles in the beginning of Aberrant Reflections, too, because... There's many ways you can go about it, right? It's a TTRPG. It's not a video game. There's not a set form of options in order that you need to use. You could capture one of the creatures. You could figure out how the mirrors work. You could get special items that let you interact with them. Having more things for the players to mess around with, more OSR style tools that they can play with and find new uses for available to them, help give them options on solving the problems that they see. So the more of those that you have, I think the better. But also, I just give an example, like they could just hire a bunch of manual laborers to go do the things that these flesh golems were supposed to do and some donkeys and stuff. But think about the consequences for doing that instead of solving this other way. If the mirror shard golem is still around, they're not going to like there being donkey poop all over the floor, right? They're here to clean up the place. The players want to be on the good side of this thing. It's going to take time to do. Wandering encounters is something that's going to be eating into the resource of time with them. So always think about the consequences if they want to sequence break or do anything else. That should always be on your mind.
I, for what it's worth, I adore the Mirror Shard Golem, and it's one of the reasons why, when I was looking at this, I thought to myself, this will be great for my quest game, because my players are the opposite of the group that's going to come in and be like, oh, a monster, kill it, right? They're going to want to absolutely know what this thing is doing and figure it out. And I love the idea that you have this creature that is ostensibly quite dangerous. I think it might be the biggest hit dice in the dungeon, and, you know, got some nasty attacks and whatnot. But he's not really there, or sorry, they're not really there to attack the party, right? They're there to, they have a job to do, and as long as the party doesn't get in their way, then they're just going to do their job.
Yep.
I love the description of the two bullets of one, morose, and two, dislikes messy guests. Like, if you just, what people wander through is fine as long as they don't make a mess. That's.
Yeah, they're really fun to play because they're coalesced shards of mirror, right? Like you don't want to touch them, you don't want to kind of get near them. They are doing their job. They've been granted sentience. They're basically like Marvin the robot. Is it Marvin the robot from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? They have all of this intelligence and sentience, and they're a janitor. They are tasked with cleaning up this place, and you're making their life more difficult. So you really don't want to get on their bad side.
That is delightful. We are now officially out of time. Chris, is there anything that we didn't get to touch on here that you want to make sure our viewers hear?
I think that's it. I had watched your episode from like the first season where you talk about kind of puzzles and some kind of struggles that you have when you go into puzzles and some ways that you can kind of circumvent that. And I wanted to make sure that I kind of address some of the things that you were talking about over there. Some things you were talking about were don't block the critical path, which I think is a good rule of thumb for puzzle dungeons. But I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. I think you can block the path if it makes sense to. I think you should have other stuff for them to do. They can always come back. This is an optional thing. You should make it multiple ways of solving the puzzles and interacting with the themes and gimmicks, right? So those multiple OSR tools. A hack, a cheat, so you can choose your own difficulty. The oracles are a really great way to do that. Asking questions, but for a price. This is how you choose your own difficulty. I want an easier route. I can't figure this out. I'm stuck. Okay, let me cut off my ear and give it to the ghoul if that's what I really need to do. But, you know, I would lean into the body horror and I would really make them say, oh, my character's doing it. Well, if everyone's okay with it, you know, you are really getting into it and going that way. But that's oh, one more thing. Make the puzzles more obvious than you think they should be. I think I heard having some issues with that before. But this is a TTRPG. We're trying to describe something that sometimes is on a piece of paper. That we need to grok it, and we need to get the players in the same mind as us thinking about the same things. That's really tough without even thinking about puzzles. So make it more obvious than you think it should be. You will not be ruining or spoiling anything. It's going to be a good time.
Fantastic.
That's it.
Great. Great. Viewers, please check out the links here in the YouTube description. If the timing is right and it's still open, absolutely get in there and back the upcoming backer kit for a Familiar Tower. Check out Chris's drive-through RPG. You can pick up some of the adventures we've been talking about there. They're just delightful, absolutely delightful. Strongly recommend you get in there and get some of this material. Great for your campaign, I'm sure.
Thank you so much for having me on. This has been great talking with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And viewers, if you do, leave us a note here in the comment section of our video. Tell us what parts of Chris's work you've incorporated into your campaign and how. We'd love to hear about it. I'm sure that Dan and I will have lots of thoughts about puzzle dungeons going forward, and we'd love to revisit this topic.
Absolutely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs and all the sites. So please look for us there and crack that like button.
If you prefer to watch, or rather, if you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, don't watch the podcasts. That's really boring. If you prefer to listen to those MP3s, you can find them on our website at wanderinggames.com. You can also find us on various third-party carriers like iTunes, Spotify, and Podcast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites, please do us a favor and leave us a review and a rating on that site. That'll help other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7 around the clock with just the best, wisest people in role-playing, frankly, about horror games and modern games and fantasy and war games and model building and miniatures and all the stuff that we adore. So we would love to see you there. Also, we'll be there for our live video after chat that Paul mentioned at the top of the hour in just about 10 minutes to continue the conversation with you one-on-one. And see what your comments are, experiences with puzzle dungeons in the past. So, Chris, thank you so much for being here today.
It's been great being really on here. Thank you so much for having me.
Fantastic. Look for Chris's stuff in the links on our YouTube description here. Best of wishes on the crowdfunding for A Familiar Tower. Hope that's a huge success coming up. And, of course, don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.